You're listening to Banter, a BMX podcast with John Doker and Anthony Berardi.
Our next guest hails from California, has been riding and competing in Flatland for nearly 40 years. He rode and toured with the iconic 80s Haro team, including Brian Blyther, Ron Wilkerson, Dennis McCoy, and Matt Hoffman. He participated in the Haro reunion show in Cologne, Germany in 2012, was featured in the classic Eddie Roman film, Ride Like a Man. He has invented iconic tricks such as the Gumby, Nuri Stan, and Miami Hopper Spin. He recently entered Marty Copa's Master of Creativity. He has operated Nuri's BMX Academy since 1999, including BMX Freestyle for classes, camps, and events. I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Dave Nuri. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Go.
Our next guest hails from California, has been riding and competing in Flatland for nearly 40 years. He rode and toured with the iconic 80s Haro team, including Brian Blyther, Ron Wilkerson, Dennis McCoy, and Matt Hoffman. He participated in the Haro reunion show in Cologne, Germany in 2012, was featured in the classic Eddie Roman film, Ride Like a Man. He has invented iconic tricks such as the Gumby, Nuri Stan, and Miami Hopper Spin. He recently entered Marty Koopa's Master of Creativity. He has operated Nuri's BMX Academy since 1999, performing BMX freestyle for classes, camps, and events. I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Dave Nuri. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Wow, that was quite the intro. Thank you, guys. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're stoked to have you, Dave. And well done, Anthony, on that intro. I know I like to write a lot of it and make you say it. So, probably not the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
Now, this is a thrill to have Dave Nuri on our podcast. This is a guy that I think Anthony and I both were definitely aware of from the 80s on. And I don't know about you, Anthony, but I always think Dave Nuri with an E, I think Ride Like a Man.
Yeah, I still have that on VHS somewhere.
I wonder if it still works. I'm sure the tracking's way off at this point. We watched that about a million times.
Yeah, sure.
So I'll go right into the I know it's cliche, but how did you get involved in BMX, Dave?
I mean, it just kind of evolved. I was just a regular kid on a bike. You know, I was originally from Chicago. That's where I grew up until I was about 9. And I moved to Southern California, San Diego, and basically just started jumping, doing the typical put the board on the bricks and jump over a trash can kind of thing. And was more of a street rider initially. Like, I would ride brakeless on a race frame and just do wheelies, jumping bunny hop, and just kind of thrashing about the city. And I used to ride my bike to school instead of taking the school bus, which was actually...
So what year did you move to San Diego, Dave?
So I moved to Chicago when I was 9, so that would have been 74. I did move back to Chicago for a couple years. So from middle school on, I stayed in San Diego, and that's when I really started riding. I mean, I've been riding bikes since I'm 5. You know, obviously, I was around bikes my whole life, but when I started really doing any kind of riding, I guess it was kind of that 13, 14, so junior high age.
So wait, did I get that straight? You moved to Chicago at 9, or you moved to San Diego?
No, I moved to San Diego, but I'm just saying that I did move back for a couple of years.
And then
since about the age of 13, I stayed in San Diego.
Gotcha. And I got to think that even when you were 9 or 10, BMX was already a thing in San Diego.
Yeah, for sure. Not so much freestyle. Like, when I saw the first rock walk was what kind of opened me up to the whole freestyle and tricks, you know, like, not necessarily, we didn't really call it flatland or ramp riding so much. We just called it freestyle.
Right. That was when you're, oh, sorry, go ahead, Anthony.
Yeah, I was going to say, right, that, I mean, it was the same here. Now, did you race, Dave, at all, or no?
No. You know, a few times people would ask me about, you know, you should come out to the track, but it just wasn't ever my thing. I always just wanted to go hang out with my buddies and just go riding, and eventually that evolved to hanging out with people at the beach, and that would consist of Jason Parks, Pete Augustin, Rick Ellison, Eddie Roman, to name a few that were kind of the regulars that we would go and have sessions at Mishmeech, and that started right around like 82, 83.
And so you're about 13 or 14 at this point?
No, at that point I would have been 17. In 83 I would have been 17. Yeah.
Right, because like Pete Augustine is from Florida, is he not?
Yeah.
Originally?
Yeah.
Okay, so he was already living out there, being a beach bum or whatever it was he was doing, I'm guessing.
Just being rad. I mean, he was the kind of guy that was very motivating. Him and I definitely... He was the guy who would call you up and say, come on, we're heading to the beach. Let's go. It's, you know, it's sunny out. We better hit the beach. So
he was a flatlander.
Well, yeah. He wrote everything, but he was definitely a flatland force by all means.
You just threw some big names out there, like Rick Ellison and Pete. Man.
Eddie Roman. Yeah.
Eddie Roman. Man.
Jason Parks.
Tell us a little bit more about that, because that's interesting to me.
I mean, that's what really fueled my passion to be a show writer. I think that's kind of how I classify myself. I mean, I do enjoy competing, but I'm really a show off. I mean, when it comes down to it, I just want to go out where there's people, there's some music, and potentially some other riders to work off of or play off of. So it was the same kind of thing that was happening in the breakdancing genre of people getting together and doing their best stuff and then like trying to one up each other in a, you know, in a fun, kind, loving way. But it was definitely, I remember like I talked about this on another show when I would see Rick Ellison, you know, I'd come up to the jam circle and I saw Rick Ellison doing like a big old rolling handstand like he does crazy, you know, down the whole block. I just get so amped up and I would just go out there and just want to like battle with him. And him and I, you know, had a lot of fun doing that. And I think that's what really helped me with being able to perform and being able to ride in front of people, because I was used to that. And so when I went to a contest, yeah, I still had nerves. I still, when they announced your date, you know, Dave Norrie from San Diego, I still felt that total shock of, oh my gosh, here I am. I got to show up and perform and be spot on. But after that initial trick, I felt like I was in my element.
There is a bit of a difference between doing a show for people and then competing in a contest, at least in my experience. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I feel like that was definitely an added benefit.
Sure.
And how that came to be is a good friend, John Peterson. So he was one of the announcers on the Haro team in 85. And actually Tony Murray.
I remember the name.
Tony Murray was not a regular at the beach so much, obviously because he wasn't really a flatland rider. But I did know of Tony, and he basically convinced me. He said, Dave, you just need to come up to Huntington Beach because there's a contest. So this would have been November of 1984. And and so it was at the OP Pro contest, surf contest, and they had the, you know, just the old school hay bale set up with a couple quarter pipes. And that was the very beginning AFA series. And that was my first introduction to performing in a contest. And I remember Mike Dominguez was one of the judges, and he was definitely, you know, him, Fiola, Ron Wilkerson, Martin, Woody, like all those guys that Mike Buff, RL, all those guys I'd seen in the magazine. And I wouldn't say like I worshiped them. I didn't necessarily have them on the wall, but I was really watching them going, wow, these guys are doing cool stuff. And to see Mike be one of the judges was very both exciting and nerve-wracking at the same time.
Mike Dominguez, I mean, geez, it's huge. Can I ask you about San Diego? I mean, were guys like Henry, remember Henry from...
Yeah. Henry Davis?
He was in Ride Like a Man, which is what I keep going to when I think of that scene. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Eddie Roman, I think, made that movie. And I remember there's one segment there where I think Kevin Martin's riding maybe a red dino in a area that I think I still see guys getting together to ride at. Is that the same place?
Yes, same place. Like in front of Hamels. Henry used to work at Hamels for a good number of years.
Okay.
And so Pat Anderson is another rider. I'm not sure if he probably got some coverage in some of Eddie's movies. And who else? Volker was also part of that, kind of in and out. Not as much. Like the first riders that I named we're kind of like the core group that were pretty much dedicated to go almost every weekend.
The beach flatland crew kind
of. Yeah, and like we would just be, that was our thing. We would bring music down and we would just create a jam session.
Yeah, that's awesome. But of course, Volker lived in San Diego, so there's plenty of segments in Eddie Roman videos with Volker riding.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Man, those videos, those Eddie Roman videos from that San Diego scene, were just everything, I think, to Anthony and I back in the day. It just seems so cool. I just can't say enough about that.
Definitely influential, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. So you're in San Diego. You started competing in AFA. Bob Morales is putting these contests together. Now, Bob's still a rider, right, Bob Morales?
At the time, no. No, he was. I didn't ever see him compete. He might have done a little bit of riding, but no, he was pretty much just organizing at that point.
Interesting. And is he not from San Diego?
I think he's from L.A. area.
Interesting. Yeah, L.A., because Rick said he was roommates with him for a while.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
And Bob might have been doing shows at that point, but I feel like I got into it just as he was kind of finishing up his riding stuff.
Interesting. Okay. Well, can I ask you about working with Eddie Roman? I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah. I just love the guy. I mean, he's just... He's such a creative artist. I mean, obviously his riding, like his street riding that he had done, is mm-hmm. just a great example of kind of how his mind works and thinks. So, you know, it wasn't like a big production. He would just literally, he was just the guy that had the camera and said, sure. Hey, Nori, let me shoot some stuff. And it was very relaxed, very, you know, laid back, and I love that about it. It wasn't like, okay, we're going to do this, and because I have done some of those kind of shoots, like the comparison where you'd go to do the 101 BMX, and it's mm-hmm. just much more official in many ways. You know, we're, you know, pick a couple tricks, and then they're going to, you know, film it, and all these other riders are there. We're in our full gear. Where mm-hmm. Eddie just wanted to get kind of capture, I think, the scene.
The lifestyle and the
uh-huh. riders, you know. And I remember one that he did where I did something. I did like a fire hydrant to Ant Rider, and I touched. Like I do a lot of – I really like to just – when I touch, I just try to dab, you know, not like walk. If I mess up, I don't just like drop my bike or walk away. I just try to cover my touches as much as possible. And sure. I did something like, you know, a pretty good little combo, but then I just dabbed. And I'm like, hey, Eddie, hey, make sure to edit that out. And Eddie's like, yeah, no worry. I'll edit that out. And of course, that's all in the video, which I thought was great, because it's like, that's what Eddie was about, just being genuine and real. And I mean, I didn't care. It's like, whatever. It's like a touch. So big deal.
I think it added to those videos because exactly. It just made it look fun. It made it look like something you wanted to do. I mean, your section and you're messing around with those two girls, and it's just like, it's ingrained in my mind. I haven't even watched the video in probably 5 years, and it's still like, I just, Eddie was amazing.
Yeah.
I think those videos had more character, more feel than pretty much anything you see even today, which is weird, but
yeah. And then
that dab is definitely an 80s thing. All 80s riders dab,
right? Yeah, I mean, it's true, Anthony, because you say that and you look at riders and they're doing, you know, a hyperspastic spinning, you know wheelchair, and it's not easy to dab on that, obviously. And you do see, I mean, Matias is amazing at that. Like sometimes you'll see Matias and he'll like just drag his foot, and you're like, how the heck do you not just completely step off the bike?
Yeah. But, wasn't Joe giving him shit about that, I think, recently? Yeah. I think so, yeah.
And we have a whole contest series that we're thinking about doing where we do a sneaky touch. It's a
sneaky
contest.
Touch.
Yeah, if we do a sneaky touch, you actually will get credit for that. You'll be judged on your sneaky touch, like how creative
how well.
It is, and how well it is, how good execution.
Execution.
Yeah, exactly. So
I watched that episode and I love the show, by the way, that you and Joe put out, and right. I think that's a great idea.
I think just mixing it up. I mean, similar to what Eddie Roman would bring to getting just like just raw footage of fun in, you know, riding and, you know, guys hanging out and busting out. We want to also give that, like, okay, look, it's not all about the most intense run that you can do for 3 minutes being judged on every, you know, every trick on difficulty, originality, and execution. What about bringing a little bit of that element of freestyle, which could be a sneaky touch? Or we did the other one, which was unexpected circumstances, where we're just saying, we just put it out there. We didn't even explain it. Some people got it, some people didn't. You know, Pete Brandt, Pete Brandt did his complete run, like totally amazing, didn't touch at all, and he should have got first, in my opinion. But we were 50% of the points for that contest was unexpected circumstances. So I think he ended up getting sixth. And I don't know how Pete feels about it. And maybe if we do it again, he'll realize, okay, there's got to be some kind of fun, you know, element. And the guy, well, the funny story is, so James McGrath got first. And he
on the tarp, right?
Yeah, no, he didn't do the tarp. He did the kids, his kids were like shooting Nerfs and then like hosing him down with a hose while he's doing like a time machine, which
was
great. And I love that he took it to that level. He had a Flatland Fuel banner as a cape on, you know, just like silliness, but
unexpected.
But, yeah, completely unexpected. But really what I loved about it was when Matt Berenger entered the contest. So I met Matt when I went to a couple of the Cornhuck jams in the last few years, and I really, you know, like Matt, and obviously he's such a great guy, and he writes everything. You know, he just
perfect spokesperson for our sport.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And he's just, his heart is in it.
He writes everything.
And when you watch him, like, he'll just go out and do a big old slider cross up, you know, and just like having fun. And I just remember that from when we first started writing. That's how it kind of evolved, right? Just going out there doing what we can do. And he's kept that alive all these years. So I called him and I said, hey, we're doing this contest. You just need to record 43 seconds and you just have to have it, you know, entered by whatever it was, you know, 3 weeks. And he's like, okay, all right. I could just hear it. He was a little bit like, a little bit hesitant.
Gears are turning though.
Yeah. And then he called me the day of. He's like, hey, I'm running behind. Can I just have a little more time? And I'm like, I'll give you 43 more minutes. You got till midnight.
43.
12:43. And then, and I was just messing with him, you know, it was fine. Like he got it in time. But what he did was he basically flipped his wheel over. So when he pedaled forward, the bike would go backwards. And he pedaled backwards around the baseball field and then slid into home base. And he ended up getting second place. He got second place doing that.
That's
which
awesome.
Is great because the judges obviously looked at it and said, you know, that was totally unexpected. And it's hard. I mean, he told me, Matt said, he tried that over and over and over. He was like beat tired. And then finally he pulled it. And he's like, but I slid into home. I'm like, yeah, but that was the best part about it. You always slide into home base when you hit a home run.
Right. That's baseball.
That's baseball. So you should have slid into home. That looks like it was actually planned, in my opinion. So I think, you know, Joe and I are just trying to offer some of those events that bring a little bit more, I don't know, fun and entertaining to it.
Yeah, kudos to you guys. I think it's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Keep up the good work, guys.
Thanks.
I think in the absence of magazines, what you and Joe are doing is really the stuff that's the glue that's bringing the sport back together, in my opinion. We see a lot of solo stuff and small clips on social media, but those segments you and Joe are doing with Factor Freestyle just, I think, is the new magazine. Yeah. In my opinion,
it's adding to the culture for sure.
And that's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the things that I really was excited about was Joe put together an edit of all the entries. I think we had about 25 or 26 people that entered, and they were from all over the world, which is great. And he just put together like a 30-minute of all the clips, and we played it at the Cornhuck Jam. And this is mostly riders that are street, park, you know, dirt jumpers, right? They're not necessarily flatland riders. And I swear, you guys, it was the best feeling to walk around and listen to everyone talk about, because they got to see, you know, everyone from Pete Brandt just busting out the most incredible, you know, I guess it wasn't 3 minutes, it was only 43 seconds, but incredible 43 seconds to, you know, Matt just doing his riding around the, you know, baseball field.
and
just their reaction. And I felt like it really was helpful to do some of that crossover, because you're right, Anthony. They probably see, most of those writers probably have seen a clip of a time machine or of a, you know, some new school kind of trick. But to see a contest, to see the variety, and to see the fun that we're having, I think it's just a good way to kind of bring it back full circle.
Yeah, amen. I agree.
Absolutely, absolutely. I don't know if this name fits what we're talking about, but I love these guys that are creative, like Eric Elstrom. Man, like those kind of, you know, those kind of writers. He's the kid from Chicago. I can't believe I'm trying to brain fart right now, but he's like a gymnast. He does all kinds of stuff. Anyway, the more variety we have in our sport, I think the better. I really think that the mainstream of Flatland is there, but you got to have those on the fringes to really make it whole. I think it's important, all of it.
Yeah. And the other aspect for us is thinking about how to make it more
inviting. Tim Noel, sorry.
Oh, Tim Noel. Yeah, I was going to say Tim Noel, but I wasn't sure if that's... Because there's another guy, too, that's out of Chicago that's been coming up that was actually at the Cornhuck Jam. But so with being able to just have a little bit more... Obviously, you have the, you know, the way that Flatland has evolved, and I've been really fortunate to watch it over the years, and I have mad respect for what writers are able to do now. And it's a bit intimidating for a 12-year-old kid to go and see something that Matias run or Alex or
any of watch Pete Brandt, they're going to run away the other direction.
It's really hard to say, what's my first thing I'm going to learn how to do is a hitchhiker to, you know, to whiplashes to, you know, upside down, you know, whatever. So I think if you have something that's a platform that's introducing this be creative mode, then it's going to hopefully keep that door open for a new writer. And I feel that's important right now. We need more.
I couldn't agree more.
We need more people.
If the sport's going to come back, it's going to come back with kids doing more elementary tricks. Not too different than that whole wheelie scene going on. You know, it's like those kids are just out doing wheelies, having a great time.
Right.
Flatland or BMX in general needs, we'll need that. But anyway, don't get me down that rabbit hole.
The last thing I want to say just about that was the guy that got second was James White. And James White was another one. And I just kind of like, I called James and I said, I'm sure I just sent a message. I sent him a message. I said, James, we're doing this contest. It would be amazing if you could enter. Well, James is not really into contests. He's never been into contests. He talked about that on our show. And, he said, but you know, it just was something that was intriguing. So getting those guys out to compete was another like blessing for us. And he did a slider. He basically did a 180 and started doing a slider at high speed, and he went across a field.
Across the whole field, right?
For like, I don't know how many, like 300 yards, like hauling. Just going across, you know, just a slider. I mean, I should say just a slider. I mean, a slider. And then he tells a story that what happened was he wanted to do a hitchhiker across that huge field. And he did the slider a few times, kind of warming up. And then one time he totally ate it and he hit some dip and just went tumbling. And then he was done. He's like, okay, I'm just going to enter the slider. But, you know, the fact that he was thinking of taking it to a hitchhiker high speed across a huge field is great. Like that was inspired because we just had this zany idea of uncertain, you know, unexpected circumstances. So, and he couldn't come out to the event because he was in England. And because we wanted to have the riders come to the Cornhuck Jam so we could have a jam there and all be together and ride, but have the contest online so anybody could enter. So we did a tribute. And I think that's what you were touching on earlier, John, where on this tarp, we were trying to think about, well, we got to do something that's a slider. So one guy said, well, why don't we get this tarp and we'll just do tricks and we'll pull each other along the tarp. So we're doing these sliders. And again, we spent like 2 hours all just trying to figure out what tricks we could do on this tarp while four guys are pulling it along. And it was so much fun. And we were basically did a tribute to John, I mean, to James, just to say, hey, you know, we're thinking of you. Sorry you couldn't come out, but we put together this little clip for you, and he loved it. It was great.
That's right.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And what an influential guy, man. James White. I mean, I think everybody's pretty stoked on that guy, old or young.
Yeah, for sure.
Amazing rider. 50, still killing it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's ask you about riding for Haro in the 80s, because I think everyone knows that Haro in the 80s was an iconic team. If you wanted to see any team, it was probably the Haro team. What can you tell us about that experience?
Man, I mean, gosh, what? I just felt so, so lucky because, as I mentioned when I did the first contest, I happened to know. So Ron Wilton was another name that I didn't mention. He was another San Diego rider that would go to the beach. He wasn't kind of a regular. We would show, you know, he would show up occasionally. Mm-hmm. And so I knew him, and we rode together a bit. But after the contest in Huntington Beach, he told me that he's got a little insight that Haro might be looking for a rider, and specifically someone that could do some ground tricks. Remember, we used to call it ground, not even flatland. We used to call it ground. Ramps and ground. And I thought, okay, cool, yeah. So he's like, I'll put in a good word. Well, about 3 weeks later, there was a contest in Lakeside, California, home of the famous Dave Volker. And I had decided to go to this contest. It was just a local event, but now I've done a contest, so I'm ready to, you know, why not do some more, right? Mm-hmm. So I went to this contest, and Bob was there. And mm-hmm. Bob came up to me, introduced himself, and I was really pleased to meet him, and, you know, had been obviously looking up to him for years. And he said, you know, let me get your number, because we might have some shows coming up in the next couple weeks, and I'll give you a call, and we can probably hook you up. And I thought, well, this is Bob Haro. He probably says this to a lot of people. Like, I didn't have my hopes up too high, but sure enough, to the day, within a couple weeks, he called me, and he said, yeah, we got some shows up in Stockton, California, and we want to get you biking and get you on the team. And that was like, I didn't even realize how much of a game changer that was. I was super excited, obviously. I got a brand new Haro. I think it was actually a Haro Freestyler. It was even before the Master. I think the 84 Haro Freestyler.
That was a dual top tube?
Yeah, it was a double top tube. It was right before the Master, I think, because I think Master was 80. I can't remember if 84 they had a Master. Anyways.
Yeah, they did.
They did? Okay, they did. So then it probably was a Master. And I just took all my parts off of my Skyway TA and threw it on the Haro.
How San Diego is that?
Yeah, exactly.
So they just give you a frame and fork, not even a complete. I guess he didn't do complete back then, did he?
They might have, but I was fine with. I mean, they gave me everything I needed to get that bike, you know, dialed and up to what I needed it to be.
And that would have been a Torker Haro, right? Like Torker was making Haro back then, I think.
Likely. Yeah, likely. So it would have been, again, like end of 84. And so I remember it was October, because we went up to Stockton and we went to. So I don't know if you guys know this, but Bob had lived in Stockton for a while and went to high school there. So he, myself, Rich Segear, Tony Murray, Ron Haro, Rhino, and Scott Haro, and Bob all went up to Stockton to do shows. Now, talk about the induction to the Haro team. I'm this like mellow stoner kid from San Diego that kind of considered himself a street rider that started to evolve into doing ground tricks. And I'm on this team. Rich Segear's like got these full-on head-to-toe Haro gear with the mirrored Oakley glasses and the full face helmet. And we went to the Halloween party, and Bob was Tarzan. He wore this tiny little – I swear to God, Bob was like bold back in the day. And Rich Segear went as a fireman, and he had this fire extinguisher. And he filled it with beer, and he'd just like pump it up and say, hey, you want a free? And he would just like fill, you know, the girls' beer. And it's like, we were definitely made a big impact at all the parties. And Bob would go and take the cassette out. So this is back in the day when we had cassettes, pop the cassette out that was playing at the party and pop his tunes in, like the, you know, the beats that he had been creating. Yeah. And we'd all like be dancing around doing the worm. And then at the end, we'd be take the tape out. Okay, the Haro team's out of here. Anyone wants to join us? Let's head the road. And by the end of the night, we literally had like 15, 16 people in this van driving around, crashing all these parties. And I swear to God, I was talking to Tony Murray. I'm like, what did I just sign up for? Like, I had no idea of what, you know, what was in store. And so that was like my initial initiation.
They're rock stars already, for sure.
That's awesome.
Was Brian Blither on the team at that point, or that was later?
That was just a little bit later. So this is just the tail end of 84, and then Brian got picked up, I'm pretty sure, January of 85, because I did my first show with him. I met him at the Winter Nationals in Chandler, and that's where Jose, at least this is the time, the first time that I see, he did the backflip at the Winter Nationals.
Backflip?
Yeah. And so, yeah, Brian, and then right after that, Ron. So it was like boom, boom, boom. They were just building this powerful, powerful team.
Wilkerson. Sure, sure. Hey, before, you mentioned some Haro names that wasn't Bob. Are those brothers?
Yeah, brothers. So
of Bob?
Of Bob, yeah. So Ron, you know Ron
Haro. Ron used to be an announcer.
Yeah. Yep. The Rhino was what he went by. And he announced for Haro and then later for Skyway.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
He was definitely a part of the scene, and he was in the magazines, and I remember seeing him.
When did Kevin Martin start announcing for Haro?
He was GT first.
Yeah, he didn't go to Haro till a bit later. I mean, he was...
Okay.
Kevin never announced for any of the summer tours that I did. The first time I was actually announced, I think, was when we did that reunion show. And you guys mentioned in the intro that it was 2012, but you do know that the first one was 2009.
I did not know that. Yeah. I just saw the one in 2012 in Cologne. So what happened in 2009?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that was the first time that I got back on a Haro. So after I rode for Haro, I rode for GT for a bit, and then Hoffman sent me a Big Daddy. So I've ridden a Big Daddy longer than I have any other bike. I rode a Big Daddy from probably 93 till 2009. So Haro contacted us and said, we're going to do this reunion show, and Stefan Pronto put this all together at the Worlds in Cologne. Mm-hmm. And I had been there before back in the 80s because we did some tours in Germany. And so I obviously knew, and I'd watched it. I had also gone to the Worlds in 96 on my own and competed. And it was like back then in 96, the old school tricks wasn't quite as cool. So
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, as it's enough, come full circle now.
Yeah. As enough time goes by, I'll be at the skate park and I'll do like a Miami Hopper and there people are freaking out. You know,
I think the same happened for Nick Watts too. He was not cool for a while and now he's like the coolest dude out there.
Yeah, exactly. So I love that. But Stefan had this whole vision, and Stefan, I mean, when he has an idea, he is all in, and he's not going to, you know,
he's
spare
the guy that's doing the Olympics, right? Same guy?
Olympics? No.
Who am I thinking of?
Bart DeJong. Bart DeJong.
Oh, okay. My guy's confused.
No, Stefan has always been a big part of the Worlds and a big part of the whole Cologne scene. And he started We the People. I don't know if you know that backstory.
Okay.
Yep. But he started We the People, big fallout with that, and I don't really know the details, but...
I getting my guys straight? I'm going to make myself look stupid here, but was he like a vert guy that also rode flat?
Like, yes.
He was overall amazing rider. Yeah.
Overall rider, did a lot of like Canadian nose pick, Canadian 360.
I got Euro Trash videos for days, and there's a bunch of him riding, and I'm just putting those two guys together.
Yeah. We met him when we first went to Germany, and he was just this little kid that could hardly speak any English. And he became a very close friend of my family. He used to come to San Diego and stay like the whole summer, and he basically lived with us. He was there when my kids were born and like was a big part of our family. So I'm very close with Stefan. Yeah.
And, oh, wow. Okay.
And so hearing this, you know, vision that Haro had, well, really Stefan had this vision and Haro was supporting him to do this reunion show, I was all in. I'm like, send me a bike, but send it to me like a month ahead, at least a month ahead, because I want to get dialed. You know, I want to get off my Big Daddy, get back on a Master. And I rode an 85 Master. So it still had remember the chainstays that were flattened out?
Yep.
And I remember talking to Haro back in the day about that. I'm like, guys, you know what? We don't actually need these anymore because we're running pegs. And it gets in the way because I was starting to do finger flips and upside down tricks, right? Because watching Seppi and Diz, that's where I got that influence from. And sure enough, Stefan sent us, you know, or Haro sent us these 85 mint condition frame and fork. That's all it was. And I just switched all my parts over and I rode it and I rode it as much as I could. And I got as dialed as I could.
Well, and it was an 85. It was an OG.
It was an OG. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it wasn't I thought it was a lineage.
No, because this was 09.
It's years before that.
Yeah. 09. And this was like, cause keep in mind the timetable is 2012 is when John Bolgen's started to really kick off with the whole remake of each bike, and 82 was the first Haro Freestyler, so he did it 30 years later, which was 2012. And we did do a Germany show there, but the 09 one, you guys should go back and look at some of the footage. I mean, the highlight for me was, just want to set the stage. There's freaking thousands of people there. It's not hundreds, it's thousands. They have bleachers and the energy. And again, I go back to that show mode, and Wilkerson has been like all along has been grooming how to have a show. Always like a beginning, a middle, and an end. Like you gotta get your lineup. And that's why I think people really respected Haro's shows, is that we really looked at it as this performance, and we had certain elements. We might not have had, well, I should speak for myself, I might not have had the hardest, most up-to-date tricks, but we were really, as a team, really dialed in our performance, and people appreciated that, right? So I remember in Germany, I'm like, guys, we need to. So Mike Dominguez was like our guest featured rider, because he was.
Wait a second, I was that 2009. I'm getting my dates confused.
Okay,
all right.
So you okay?
Kevin Martin announced. Yep. Mike Dominguez.
Yep.
Ron Wilkerson. Blyther.
Yep. Myself.
You,
yep. And then
that was it.
Yeah, 2012 was when Dennis McCoy was there. That was
okay,
3 years later.
I missed that one.
Yeah,
2009. But that was amazing. That was one of the most amazing things I've ever witnessed. I just got
to
say that.
Yeah, so if you were there, you know what I'm trying to describe as far as that energy, right? These are all – okay, and I've been to Cologne several times since then, and it's always been the case where the energy and the pure, like, passion – this is not just a BMX crowd. This is like – These are
amazing.
Super fans that are
it's
loving.
A party.
Yeah, they love every aspect of the sport, especially
The
old school. Like the riders that are now in their 40s or you know early 50s are there with their kids and their families, and they're like, "Hey, this is what I grew up with. You know, this is my this is the thing that I love to do and I still do or what have you." And I've always felt that with that energy in Cologne. So just remember my highlight was when we finished the show, they're doing their last trick, and Brian and Ron would always do their double little routine, and it's a really rinky-dink little quarter pipe, because again, Stefan's vision was to create an old school.
The original show.
Yeah, the old school bikes, the leathers, everything about it, the ramps, and I remember Ron and Brian were like, "Oh my gosh, these ramps are so hard to ride because you don't ride."
So, what were they like? 6 feet wide? No,
they were 8 foot wide, I think. Okay,
yeah.
So
he's doing pedal picker drop ins.
Yeah.
Ron is eating shit. He's like,
and it just
years old.
It's just right to vert, you know. And so, so I want to just backtrack a little bit. So, like the beginning of the show, I had this idea. I'm like, you guys, we should go gear up in the van, and then when Kevin announced us, we'll all come out. And like, it was just a little idea that I just threw it out there, but we used to do that back in the day at the shows, at the bike shows, right? We'd have the announcer saying, "Okay, we got the Haro team, they're just getting ready, and you guys pumped up," and then we'd all come out and get on our bikes and fly up on top of the ramp. So that was our intro. So I wanted to do something like that, and that worked great. But the end was like amazing. And there's a clip that just, I could watch it for eons because it just captured so much. Brian and Ron were on the kick turn ramp. And I know the conversation. It was like, it went like this. Ron says, dude, let's do the air over 540. Brian's like, dude, you're crazy. You're not even going 2 feet. Ron's like, dude, I'll pedal as fast as I can. I promise. All you got to do is spin underneath me. You'll pull it. Dude, Ron, you're crazy. I'm not doing it. Come on, Brian. This is the frickin' world. Come on. I swear, I know word for word. I mean, you have these guys on the show and you ask them, and I bet you that's exactly what they're going to say. And so, sure enough,
the energy was there.
Yep, the energy was there. Wilkerson was determined. Brian was like, okay, you know. And I don't know if you've seen that footage. But
oh, I saw it. I took footage of it. I'm going to find that and share that on Instagram.
Yeah, please do.
It's amazing.
And that's the last time to date that I know that they've done the Arrow of 540. But what was crazy about it is, yes, I give credit to Ron. He did do a much bigger air than 2.5 feet or whatever. He did like a good 4 foot air. And
oh, pulled it perfect.
Yeah, but perfect in the sense that they pulled it, but it was so close. Like, he's spinning that 540, and the way that Brian does 540s, he doesn't like loft it and float. He just like hucks it and spins in a real tight circle. You know what I'm saying? Like right at the top, just barely out of the quarter. And it was so close. And I just like nearly crapped my pants. I was like, oh my gosh. That was
you
it.
And a thousand
other yeah, people. and that ending, where, you know, there's just nothing I can even compare that to.
People went nuts.
Yeah, it was insane.
So rad. Yeah, and then
that's awesome.
Yeah, old partied at the campsite. That
yeah, exactly.
Those contests are, there was no sleep if you camped there.
Right, exactly.
But amazing. Yeah. Hopefully we can do that again sometime.
For sure. Well, there's a possibility. We've been talking about maybe doing some more shows together, Ron, Brian, and I.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah. There's a point where, you know, if you're like 55 years old, you're doing over-unders, you got to start being careful.
I know, but this is Ron and Ryan. I mean,
Ron
is still busting out of the man bowl, and he's doing, you know, he wants to do, I think his latest goal is like 12 feet out of the man bowl. It's like, okay, Ron.
So, Dave, when you were touring in the 80s with Haro, you were with the Blyther Wilkerson. There was two teams, right?
Yeah.
Like two tours.
Yeah. So 90% of the time I was there. I did have 1 year when McCoy broke his ankle and I had to fill in. Funny story that happened there is they flew me into someplace in, I think, Texas. And basically, I don't know how Dennis twisted his ankle or broke his ankle, but we're looking to do the next show. And we have this book. So we have this master book. And in the book has all the information for the bike shop. And has the guy's name and information and phone number and the location. And then you have a map, right? You usually have like an atlas because you're touring all over the country. These guys had a freaking map, a one-page fold-out map, and they're trying to find this suburb in Dallas, you know, like Arlington, not even Arlington, like a smaller suburb than Arlington in Dallas. And I'm like, you guys, where's your atlas? I go, let's go to the gas station. You guys need to get an atlas to figure this out, because, and I just thought it was really hilarious that they're traveling around the freaking country with a map.
With one map.
One page map. You know, just that you fold out and try to, you know. Oh, yeah, it's hilarious.
No detail. Yeah.
Wow. Awesome. So, so you've been performing shows since that time, right? You've been doing shows with your own company, which is Dave Nuri
BMX Academy.
Yeah.
BMX Academy.
Yeah. So I started that like when I moved here in, 98. So 99, I think, is when I started. I started this event called Bike It, which was just a jam. And we'd have some ramps out there, like a box jump. And then we had just fun little things like drag races and bunny hop contest. And just a kind of a fun, again, just trying to get more people into BMX. And then I would do my flatland, and I have a little story that I do, and I have these different bikes that I use, like a single wheel bike I call BC wheel, and I have a wooden wheel with just two pedals on it, and then I have a ghost bike, and I just mix all these different bikes up and tell a little story behind it. And I've done that on and off on different levels. For a while, I was just doing annual events and then just doing shows and some clinics like at the Y. And then most recently, over the last couple of years, I kind of ramped it up and I started doing this thing called Gumby Land, and it's like a bike pop-up. So it's a pop-up bike park that I just bring some little ramps, just little wedges and a couple little launch ramps. And then I do flat land and a little bit of basic jumping. And that's been a lot of fun. It's just, again, trying to exposes many young riders to the sport.
Okay, so if people want to hire you, how would they find you?
DaveNorrie.com or any Instagram. You know, Instagram is Dave Norrie and Facebook is Dave Norrie as well.
Okay. Do you do schools?
Some, but I haven't really, like, I haven't really promoted myself in the school arena.
Right, right. Okay. And you and your lady are doing a school of your own in a way, right?
Correct. So we have a preschool that I do 3 days a week in the morning. And it's a Waldorf base. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Waldorf.
No.
Well, how about Montessori?
Sure.
Okay. So similar in many ways, kind of nature based, primarily an outdoor program. And it's really my wife, Paula, that's got all the, knowledge and experience in that world. Her kids, she has three children and she put them all through that Waldorf education and, just really supporting. I mean, my beliefs are in line with it because it supports the whole child. It's not so much about at the young age of intellectual learning. It's more about getting the child socially adapted in their physical being. So a lot of movement and just allowing them to play. So it's basically learning through play, which is exactly what I feel like I gained being a freestyle rider, right? Like you just,
right.
You have something that you want to accomplish and like, wow, you see someone do something, you want to learn it or add to it. And that's just healthy in so many ways for your cognitive as well as your fine and motor skills, fine motor skills and large motor skills. So it's all incorporated. And I dabble a little bit with bikes. Right now we have a scoot bike and I actually have some ramps out at the school, but it's not a big part of the program. It's just kind of there as another means to, you know, have them play and entertain themselves.
Very cool. Very cool. I got to say, I think the system that we've been using for the last 50-100 years where we sit in a class for 8 hours a day is, you know, it's questionable. So
yeah, I think it's ludicrous.
Alternative ideas are good.
Yeah, I think it's ludicrous. I mean, and I'm a good example. So I went to this alternative school in San Diego. It was called John Muir. Actually, Pete Augustine was another person that went there. So he and I, he's a little bit older. So in high school, we didn't really hang out so much. Later on, when we became more into riding, that's when we became closer in the beach scene. But in high school, we both went to this alternative school. And I mean, it was just like we had meditation class. We had Donahue class. We'd watch Donahue and then we'd have to write like a paragraph on the subject that Donahue talked about. Like crazy. And that was English, you know. That was
what?
Yeah. And so I mean, I think there's pros and cons. I think academically it probably set me back. I feel like I could have got a better education in some realms. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I got to do, I mentioned earlier that I took the decision to ride my bike for 45 minutes instead of sitting on a bus. So this was a magnet school. So magnet schools will have, you know, bus kids from all over the mm-hmm. city. And I just didn't want to sit on a bus for 45 minutes each way. I'd rather be riding my bike. Well, I freaking got PE credit. So I did this independent study and I got credit for riding my bike to school.
That's
cool.
Awesome.
Right? Because I
never got credit for that. I never took the bus. Man.
Yeah, I just like, I don't know, I found out about this independent. I'm like, hey, can I do it for bike ride? And it was not even freestyle. It was like, I'm just riding. It was just the physical activity. But who, right. You know, who would have ever guessed? Because that was just when I was starting to get into riding. I saw someone do, I think it was about 81 or 82, and I saw the first rock walk. And that like opened up my world from just doing wheelies and jumping. And I saw the guys in the magazines, like I saw Mike Buff and RL doing the, they're riding on the head tube, you know, with the direct drive. I saw that stuff, yep. But I just couldn't, again, I couldn't relate to how I could do that on my current, you know, Schwinn, comp race frame, right? That was three wheel brakeless. Like that's what I rode. There's a picture of me in my yearbook of me doing, I have long hair and a Pendleton. I'm just got this like stoner vibe going in my 501 jeans. And I'm doing a foot jam on this bank. And it's about a four and a half, maybe 5 foot bank. And it's relatively steep. And I'm doing a full on big old like foot jam at the top. And then coming back and rolling down. I went there years later. And I was like, man, I can't do that. That's burly, you know? So I felt like, and I used to get in trouble for riding my bike on campus. I learned how to do 360s like in the classroom. One of the, actually the class that we had meditation had these big pillows, and I set up these big pillows, and I could do 180s, but I couldn't do 360s yet. And I remember learning them in the classroom. And I always would get in trouble, like, Mr. Norrie, you can't ride your bike in school. You can't ride your bike in the classroom.
What?
Yeah.
I wish I went to this school.
Yeah, so it definitely supported my desire to, you know, to ride and have fun.
Wow. That sounds very California.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I saw this on a Facebook group recently. So you're in the camp of rock walks, no breaks.
Mm-hmm.
There was an argument whether rock walks are breaks or no breaks.
Right. I think.
Do you use breaks if you do a rock walk today?
I can do them both. I mean, I still can do them without breaks, but I did eventually start to do them more with breaks. I don't do a lot of rock walks. So, but I remember having this conversation with somebody, and I'm like, okay, I think I was teaching a class, and they were saying, what's your first trick? And I go, well, the first real trick that I think of, besides wheelies and just bunny hop and jumping, was this rock walk. And they're like, okay, let's see it. And then I said, well, I got to show it legitimately how I first saw it. And that was a kid. I mean, just some kid in San Diego that I saw do it in the street. And I was like, I gotta do it. And I spent, a few days or a week on it, just practicing, probably bending a few rims in the process. But I had to do it breakless for the kids to show them.
Cool.
And as John and I have said before, back then your brakes were terrible anyway, so just about everything was brakeless.
Yeah, exactly. Another funny story about that era that my mom was my first sponsor, as many of us had that, you know, parents would just basically fork out the money. My mom, one day when I came home, she's like, David, so tell me a little bit about your bike riding. And I'm like, what do you mean, Mom? She's like, well, you're pretty good on that bike. And I go, well, what? Yeah. I mean, whatever. Like, I just go out and ride. She's like, no, I saw you down University Avenue, which is like a big major street in San Diego. It was one of the best lines because you could go down some of these big hills. And then if you made the light, you could go through this one street intersection and hit this perfect gas station where all it was a little bit of a wedge to a big drop off into the gas station. So all you had to do is just like launch off of it and you could just sky. And it was so fun. And again, this is brakeless on a freaking freewheel. Like I don't know. I can't believe that.
This is in San Diego, right?
This is San Diego. This is probably, you know, again, 82, maybe 83, but probably 82. And so my mom is like, well, no, I saw you. And what happened was she was driving down the road and she's with a friend. She's like, wow, look at that kid over there. Look what he did on that bike. And then I did some kind of like trick where I like did a little look back and she saw my face. And she's like, oh my gosh, that's my kid right there. And so she sat me down and she's like, oh, so it's pretty cool what you're doing. And I was like, you know, as at that age, you know, you're a teenager and you're just kind of blowing it off. Like, yeah, whatever, Mom, it's no big deal. Right. But she was a very, and still to this day has been such a great supporter in everything that I've done, both creatively and, you know, traveling and all that.
Well, shout out to Mom.
For sure.
Shout out to all our moms. Even my crazy mom. Did you ever come across the likes of Vic Murphy while you're out there?
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I think of a wedge parking, you know, like a parking lot wedge or something.
Yeah. And Vic Murphy. And I went over to the, his house a few different times. They had a little mini ramp in the back, and Brad, what's Brad's last name? Yeah, Blanchard. And they would just be shredding it, and they're always a lot of fun and just kind of living the lifestyle fully. And we had Vic on our show, and it was great because we were talking about how Skyways were basically Dirt Brothers. And he described it as, well, we just called Skyway up and said, hey, we want some frames. And that's what they sent us. So we put stickers on it, you know. And, oh, yeah. You know, it was just, and that's the kind of stuff that you could do back in those days, right? And just like, and I don't know. I feel like that whole scene was another great representation of the scene and of that, I don't know, just the people just really out there doing what they love to do. just go and shred and having fun.
I think that San Diego scene's been influential for years. It still is today. You still got amazing riders down there. Dennis Anderson. And I mean, everybody moves to San Diego if they can. Right? So amazing. Awesome. And so you were sponsored by Haro back in the 80s, and you're still on Haro today. Is that right?
Yeah, so kind of interesting. So right now, my main sponsor is Reclamation Bikes. And so that's Fred Gates and Robert Riley. And
Rob Riley, good guy.
Yeah, both of them have just been amazing. So a few years back, I was at some event, and I was talking with Fred, and I'm like, Fred, I really want to do more. I love being in Oregon and spreading as much I can here locally, but there's a big world out there. And he's like, oh, well, just let me know, like, where do you want to go, and I'll help you out. And I'm like, okay, cool. And so I started to, like, hit him up. I'm like, hey, I think I'd like to go to this Cornhook Jam, or I'd like to go to York Jam, or I'm thinking about going down to this jam in San Diego or what have you. And he's been like the biggest support over the, I would say, the last 3 years than anyone, because
he's been helping you get to those events and stuff.
Yes, he's been helping to get to AFAs. He's been helping me to get to pretty much anything that he feels is going to help support, you know, sharing what I still love to do with the world. And
they seem like a legit sponsor. Was it Jason Plourd got flown all over the place when he was riding?
No, they do a lot. I mean, also Dub. I mean, when Dub was traveling more, which he isn't now, they were flowing him and sending him all over the place as well. And the thing about it was, I go, well, you know, I'm kind of riding Haro, and like, Haro is kind of in my blood again now. And I can't see, you know, riding a Reclamation, but he's like, oh no, it's all good, like, fine, wear a shirt occasionally.
He did. So he's sponsoring you even though you're not riding his bikes,
right? He doesn't have it, and it goes back to kind of like what he, I met Fred when I did some shows in Japan. We were there together for about a month, and it just goes back to what he wants to do is just promote the fun and the great aspects of the sport, which is exposing people to BMX, of all riding, right? And I just can't thank him enough. So, Fred, if you're listening, thank you again. You've done an amazing job getting Gumby to continue to travel the world.
That is pretty amazing.
And so Haro is still a big part, and they flow me products. And they did fly me down to San Diego this last year for a show that they did. So I kind of have my foot in both directions. Like, I got, you know, Reclamation that's been really helpful with traveling, and then I still got the product flow from Haro.
And you're on Vans as well?
Yes. I originally rode for Vision back in the day, and then I got picked up on Vans, and they've been sending me shoes for I don't even know how long. And that's another just very fortunate thing that I just feel grateful that they're, again, supporting me to just spread the word.
Very cool. Yeah, you're the envy of pretty much any BMXer in their 20s. It seems like they all wear Vans.
Yeah, right.
Very cool. All right, and so let's talk about Factor Freestyle. I know we touched on a little bit before how you guys are just kind of making it fun, but how did you get working with Joe Sisman? And obviously you guys have broed down quite a bit. How'd that all happen?
Yeah, the initial, Joe and I met at one of the AFA contests. So when James McGraw started doing AFA and he had an old school class, I was like all in. And at first I was flying myself to these contests and flipping for the bill just because I just wanted to go and compete. Even though I wouldn't say, like I said earlier, I'm a competitive rider, but mm-hmm. It was right when I hit 50 is when I think he started it. And I was like, old school class, I still have a few, you know, tricks up my sleeve. I'm going to go and compete. And it was a different level of competing for me, because I wasn't doing it for any reason for a sponsor. And not that Haro ever gave me any grief about my competitive rankings. You know, they were like, mm-hmm. we're going to send you to the Master Series AFA. And, you know, it was great. And I kind of first few contests I did really well, and then I just slowly started, you know, dropping the ranks because the sport just evolved much quicker than I did. But they never, you know, I just want to make sure I say that Haro was always supportive of me, of a rider, whatever I ended up, you know, pursuing, whether it was primarily just a show rider and shows or a contest. But when I went back to the AFA, when I hit 50, I just was really inspired in a new way. Joe and I met, we just kind of really got along, and we just, when the pandemic hit, we were just talking on the phone one day, and we're like, what we're missing is the contest where we could have opportunities to talk and share stories, and like share stories what you heard and confirm stories. And that's kind of how the whole name Fact or Freestyle came to be, where right. We want to say, oh, well, so-and-so said this. Well, wait, let's get that person on a call and let's see what, you know, they remember. And I didn't know Joe quite at the level that I do now. And now it's very interesting, and I'm sure you guys have seen the kind of role that we each have. He's like the one, I give the example of like a talk show host. He's a guy that's like the shock jock, right? He pushes the envelope and he pushes the agenda and the storyline way further than I would ever. And I'm like the Dr. Laura, right? I want to like help people and like say, hey, so what's happening? How is your life working for you? What can you do to make it better so you can ride more, or, you know, health, you know, wise or whatever. And so there's that dynamic. And honestly, right now it's a little bit challenging, I have to say, guys, because it's like Joe and
he'll take the piss at anybody.
He'll, well, perfect, he's lethal. Perfect example. I mean, just ruthless. To bring it to date, John, when you posted something and you dropped my E on my last name, right?
Oh,
and
that was a big mistake.
It was a big mistake because Joe, and he sent me a text. He said, as your, I can't remember, publicist, editor.
Executive producer. Yeah.
Executive producer. And like, and I'm like, I always am like, whoa, like pulling the reins, Joe. And I can only do so much. And
he's just taking the piss at everybody.
I haven't met Joe in person, but I think he's awesome for the sport. He's like a glue that brings the guys together. And, you know, he's got on me about a couple things too. And I think, you know, about my accent and the way I pronounce things. And, but to me, that's great. If you can't laugh at yourself and you can't have one of the guys that, I mean, I think he's great for the sport and he's busting your chops. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That to me is great. That's what we need.
And I think there's something about, especially in a close community where you'll call someone out. Okay. I'll tell you a Pete Augustin story because I love the guy to death and he used to give me crap, you guys. And this is Pete Augustin. And I looked up to him not only because he's going to look like he's going to punch me in the face if I crossed him.
Intimidating guy. Exactly. At some point, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But he's, 90s, you're like,
yeah, but he's, you know, he's got the biggest heart and he's awesome on so many levels. And like, we're closer than we ever have been. But, okay, the story goes, when I was on Haro and I got the full on, now I'm like completely decked out. I got a brand new master, like the latest one, bright neon. And I come rolling up and he's like, oh, here comes Haro's little puppet. And it was like that dig, right? And because guess what? I kind of was Haro's puppet. Like I was out there doing shows and like they say, you know, not that they would ask of me of anything that I wouldn't feel, you know, happy to do, but he was just giving me crap because he was the primary influence on people to keep it real. He's the first one to start to show his tats and wear street clothes and a skater helmet and not.
When he came on the scene, he was the man.
Yeah.
He made me, chrome up my bike and get mags.
Exactly.
Fakey wall rides. I was like Pete Augustin.
Shave your head. Yeah, shave your head.
And get some tattoos. Right. I never did any of that, but what, you know. Almost.
But the point that, so as when you're, you know, teenager, you know, that still was like a blow. And I've talked to him about this. So he knows how I felt. And it's just an ongoing joke that we have back and forth of how he was just, you know, just saying like, okay, yeah, here's a full factory rider, and we're at this jump. So basically going back to the roots, because that's what I used to do is jump, and there was this drop-off. I remember like it was yesterday at Babel Park, there was this ledge, and it was probably about a 3 or 4 foot drop off this wall into this canyon, and then it was just shooting up the canyon to a big step-up. You know, and step-up, I did a lot of those kind of jumps where you could just launch yourself, and then you land way up on the hill, and it was so much fun, and you didn't have to learn how to, you know, basically not case it on the landing, because you just land flat. So I wouldn't drop in. I was like scared shitless because I had a coaster brake now. I had this, you know, flatland ready bike. It was not my Schwinn's, you know, comp that was all race ready, and I hadn't been doing much of that. And so he's like, "Come on, you full factory hard rider, can't you drop in on this?" And
still to this, just giving you shit.
Exactly.
That's what friends are for, right?
Right. So, you know, bringing it back to the factor freestyle, I'm doing my best to hold that, because I'm like, Joe, like we got to make sure, like, if the person's not on the call, we have to be very careful, because I want to be able to give them the opportunity to speak into it. I don't want to just be saying, you know, talking about some issue that could be offensive or ruffle someone's feather. That's not what I'm about, at least. So I'm trying to constantly bring it back to, okay, yeah, let's call each other out. And there's been a lot of great stories and great, I don't know, people just sharing experiences that they may not have in any other, you know, kind of podcast, because we just go there. We go to, you know, the extent. And that's the one story that came about with the Is Bob Harrow an Overgripper? Have you guys heard about that?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So what I was just happening, you know, to share that story I shared earlier. And you notice I added that part when I told it. But Bob, when he met me at that contest in Lakeside, he literally I had just finished my run, and he came up and he introduced me, "Hey, I'm Bob Harrow. I'd like to meet you. I'd like to get your number and maybe set you up with some product." And he just crushed my hand. Well, I told that story when Pete was on there, and Pete was like, "Oh my gosh, that guy did the same thing to me." And Joe took that, and he's run with it for a year. Like, and it's not even the end. It's like,
no.
Yeah. So it's a lot of fun, and it's a little nerve-wracking at times, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think, like, sometimes you need those guys that'll get you into your comfort zone, though, too, right? You know, just, yeah. I think you guys have a great show. I like it. It's enjoyable, and I kind of, you know, every once in a while need my chops busted.
You're right. Well, and I'll tell
that's
you...
That's the truth.
I'll tell you another really good one that I kind of use as an idea behind what I hope that Fact and Freestyle can bring about. So, I've talked to this through with Eddie Roman. So I'm just very careful in that when I share stuff, it's like Eddie has heard this story and Eddie has known, you know, what that experience was for me. So in like 87, I'm at the Velodrome and I'm competing pro, and I'm probably like at this point ranking between 6th and 9th, you know, like I'm not top 5 at this point. And, I'm just doing my usual, you know, Nori style and kind of, you know, mostly my original tricks, not a lot of new stuff, but whatever. I'm just doing what I do. And I overhear Fiola right after my run say to somebody else, "Oh, yeah, that was Nori, just finished his run. His pedal, half his routine, his pedal was on the ground." And I was crushed. I was like, oh, man, like Eddie was like my hero. Like he was the guy. And I wasn't that close to Eddie. It was, you know, we were mutual friends or whatever. I mean, we had mutual friends and we got to hang out a little bit. But it wasn't like I would go and session with Fiola. I just would see him in different cases. And I still held him in really high regards, right? And it was just crushing to hear that. And I never said anything for years. I just, like, tucked that away and whatever, blew it off. So when they released Joe Stingray BMX, I drove down to LA for their release, their launch, and we were at Robert Castillo's house, and Eddie was there. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was because I had a few beers, or I just felt very comfortable. I went up to Eddie and I'm like, "Hey, Eddie, I wanted to mention something
WTF.
To you."
WTF?
Yeah. And I'm like, I just wanted to tell you, like, you know, obviously over the years you've been so inspirational to me, and I and I learned a lot of your moves, like even that little pedal stall. You know when Eddie would fly, like go really fast, and then he would just stall on the pedal? Then he would kick his leg. Yeah, kick his leg and then spin the bike around. Like so much style. Yep. Well, and I did that maybe not nearly as classy as he did, but that was one of the things. And then when I watched that, I'm like, oh, okay, so we can put the pedal down. And then I saw RL do pedal spins, so I did pedal spins. And I just started doing more stuff on the pedal. And when I did the handstand, I'm like, oh, I can do it on the pedal. And then I...
He influenced this whole move in your riding.
Exactly. Like, whatever half the routine that I did on the pedal, you know, was a big part of Eddie. So I didn't go into all of that, but I just, you know, kind of mentioned, like, hey, you know, your riding was very influential, especially some of those pedal stalls. And and I remember one time I was at the Velodrome, and, you know, I overheard you said something, and it just really... really crushed me. And he's like, dude, what? I don't even remember that. And for God, forgive me. I was probably just joking around. And it goes back to kind of that factor freestyle thing. You know, it's like, if I would have had a platform, we could have, like, you know, hashed it out there, you know, and got clarity. And as a kid then, you know, I say a young teen, I was probably 20 at the time, but a very young rider, I just didn't feel comfortable going up to Eddie Fuel and saying, you know, hey, dude, you actually, You put me in that position because that's what I, you know, saw you do.
I was following your lead,
yeah,
dude.
Yeah. And
well,
so
it was Eddie Fiola. I mean, he was a big deal.
The king.
Yeah.
The king.
And Eddie, you know, and Eddie was so gracious about it. And I just really, and, you know, and again, it's like our relationships with all these guys, they go so deep because I think we have a lot of time and we have a lot of stories to share and a lot of the same desires that we're here for the love of sport.
It kind of reminds me, and I've told this story before, I used to be a big R.L. Osborne fan, never met him, nothing like that, thought he was the best, and I used to not like Dennis McCoy, because Dennis McCoy always was beating R.L. at the time in AFA contests, and I just thought he was kind of a young gun punk, whatever, and I met Dennis McCoy at the 91 Florida State Fair. He's riding with the Sprocket Jockeys with Hoffman, Rick Thorne, and he was the nicest guy I'd ever met. So gracious, took the time to talk and chat and hang out. And I thought, man, just my perception of him was totally different than what he was really like.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Maybe part of the Eddie thing was just that you were competitors. And he's, you know, when you're competing, especially in the pro level, people are going to talk some shit, you know. The Jamie Bestwick was just on the Unclick podcast.
Okay.
He was talking about being on the deck with, like, Dave Mura and Jay Muron and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Kevin Robinson. And you know, they would just be competitive. So, like, they would almost develop little tiffs with each other. Or they would just not like each other because they're competitors. You wonder if that was a factor.
Yeah, you know? it definitely could have been. And I think he just, you know, he blew it off, like, didn't remember it, so it was like not even a big deal. Obviously I was the one that was holding it for so many years.
You've been dwelling on it for 34 years.
Yeah. And it's not like I really felt like I was dwelling on it. It's just like I saw Eddie again, I'm like, okay, that's a little something that was unspoken, and here's an opportunity to speak it through. And that's what I would just like to, like, model for other people, because it's like, why not, you know, speak your truth, like, speak up about it's the same thing I do with the 5-year-olds. It's like, well, you got a problem with that person, you need to tell them. Or if they said something you don't like, you just say, hey, I don't appreciate that, you know, and or that it hurt my feelings, you know, that I was upset about it. Because I, you know.
Especially when it comes to your partner.
Yeah.
Things that are important.
Yeah, exactly. And just going back to the Haro tour, like, I was so fortunate that I got to be put on the team. Primarily, I spent 90% of the time with Ron and Brian. And my gosh, like, we never fought. We never had any of that. It was amazing. Right. The chemistry between the three of us. I asked Ron on our show, or maybe Joe asked him, and Ron's like, dude, I don't ever remember fighting with Gumby. There was never. We all had our own roles. Like, I was the tour mom. I mean, going back to, like, you know, just making sure that everyone's taken care of and thinking about everybody's, you know, I don't know, that we eat well, and we shouldn't just eat Denny's every night. Like, we should probably, you know, eat some good healthy food occasionally, and like all this, you know, stuff that I just had attention on. And then Ron was the business guy. Like, he was making sure that the shop was, you know, handled right and professionally and all that. And Brian, the best way I describe Brian is we were broken down on the side of the road. We were fixing the van, the tire, And we're getting the jack out and taking all the bikes out, finding the spare. We're like, where's Brian? What's Brian doing? Brian, what are you doing? I'm trying to find you guys a radio station. And we're like, that's Brian in a nutshell. Like, that's how he would orchestrate his position all the time. He would get away with just being a slacker by just holding the, I don't know, just the, what is it? It's a carefree attitude. I guess that's what I would say. He just had a carefree, loving, you know, attitude all the time.
Right. He wasn't helping, but it's hard to get mad at him.
Exactly. He's a chill dude. Exactly.
Right. I did hear he coined the phrase getting rad, and I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
He's a California chilling dude. That's cool. It is interesting. Getting guys that have chemistry to go on the road is so important. If you can't get along, it's just going to be a problem. And that's the hardest thing about sending guys on the road, I think.
Yeah. Well, you have a lot of experience with that, John, because do that now to this day. And yeah, there's always drama. It's more than if someone were to be married, you know, you usually don't work together, you know, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that you do that you have separate. But when you're on the road, you're doing everything. You're basically performing together. You're rooming together. You're eating together. You know, there's
joined
not.
At the hip.
Yeah, you're not a lot of. There's not a lot of downtime or, you know, away time. So you got to face your facts.
I was going to ask in those 80s Haro tours, like it was scheduled tight, right? Like you were doing a show, packing up, moving on to the next one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you didn't have a lot of time to relax or you know, when I was a kid, I was like, you know, that's the dream. Let's get in a van and just do shows everywhere. And but the reality of it was probably a lot different.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it was crazy. We would be driving we'd do a show, we'd pack up. A lot of times if we had time, we would go to the local kids' half pipe and have a barbecue. That was always the best, and ride a little bit with the local scene. We did a lot of that, but sure. Then we'd have to like hit the road, drive, you know, all night or 8 hours until the wee hours of the night, and then find a hotel room, and then we're booking for the next show. So there's many times, and you know, Bill Hawkins, rest in peace, he's gone now, but he was the organizer of the tour, and he did a great job. But you know, there's one thing when you look down on a paper as a list of shows, and the other thing of actually getting from point A to point B constantly throughout the whole summer. It's taxing, you know, it wears you out.
It's interesting that you did tour with Ron, because Ron Wilkerson was my introduction to shows altogether.
Oh, wow.
He hired me to be the TM in 2003. And then from there, I was like, oh, I can do shows. Yeah, that tour is probably a little different than Haro. I can remember two hip tour, 6 weeks on the road, $600 for hotel budget for the entire 6 weeks, $75 a show, and there wasn't that many shows, and then we got I think $18 a day per diem.
Yeah,
and it was just a shitty van. Wires were hanging out of every tire, like no radio. The radiator overheated as soon as we got to the desert, and I'm like, wow, this is Ron Wilkerson's setup. Like, this is the man that's been doing this for years. I can only imagine, you know, how it was dealing with him when, you know, it was all new. It must have been fun.
Yeah, for sure. And really with Haro, I mean, I think it's looking back, it's kind of crazy. It's like, yeah, here's the keys to this, you know, beautiful van and trailer and all right? this equipment. And just,
nice stuff.
Just go. And going back to
you guys are kids.
Yeah, I was 18 or 19 at the time. Wow. And we were all young. Ron was about the same age, and Brian was even younger. And I remember when we were traveling from actually the Seattle area, and we had a drive over to Denver. And this is 85, so first tour I was on, John Peterson was driving. And we're going through the Mountain Rockies, and it's late night, 10, 11 o'clock at night. And we all of a sudden saw this deer. I saw it run across the road, and it stopped. Saw our headlights and froze. And and John was just like froze as well. And then the deer tried to run back, and it didn't make it. John locked up the brakes, we started sliding, and the trailer just pushed us, hit the deer, sent it over the side. And we didn't have cell phones, obviously, at the time, so we're stranded, and we're trying to, find people down. People would pull over. Yeah, we'll call ahead. We'll go and call ahead, and we're out there for, like, a good hour, hour and a half, so it's, like, well past midnight by now. This old guy comes pulling up in this big old Ford truck with this big grill. It's got, like, deer hair all hanging off the edge. He's like, oh, you looks like you guys hit a deer. I hit about 10 or so a year, and I'll get you towed off to the next town. And we're like, all right, but sketchy as hell, because the guy just took this chain and hooked it up to our bumper, tied it onto his truck, and we start getting pulled along this mountain road
with the trailer
still the trailer, whole rig, and this old Ford pickup truck, beat up, and then we're like looking in the back of his bed of his truck. He's got all these beer cans, and I remember Peter's going, man, this is kind of sketchy, guys. Like, this guy, if this guy goes off the edge, we're going with him. And it was all fine, but still, again, pretty dramatic. And we get to this small little town. Tiny little town. There's like a gas station, a little general store, and we park the van at this gas station. We get up early in the morning. We talk to him, the coolest mechanic. He basically welded our radiator so that we could use it, because he couldn't replace it. So he just needed to weld half of it so he could still have retain water for half of it, and we could drive it at least. And he bent the bumper up, fixed some of the lighting that got damaged, and we were on the road. And I remember calling my mom. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to our next show in Denver, and we're running a little late because we hit a deer. And she stopped and she said, "What? You hit a deer? How did you hit a deer?" Well, when we were driving over the Rocky Mountains, it was late night and a deer jumped out in front of us. She's like, "You're driving across the country?" She thought I was freaking flying. She had this idea that I got on Haro and I was like this superstar being flown to or bust. I don't know what she had in mind, but she didn't realize I was just on the road in this van with a bunch of other teenagers.
You just think it was a little more glamorous.
She had a different vision entirely. And I'm like, yeah, we're driving. She's like, oh my gosh, David, I can't believe it. And then the other funny part is that we're all sleeping, Ron's driving. And now it's probably 8, 9 in the morning. The van's fixed, and we're just trying to get a couple of hours of sleep before we show up in. Actually, Colorado Springs is when we ended up doing that show that day. And on the radio, they said, "Oh yeah, we're out here at Bob's Bikes and More, and we're waiting for the Haro Freestyle team. Apparently, they ran into a few problems last night. They ran into a deer, but they'll be here any minute. Come on down to Bob's Bikes and More for the Haro team." And Ron's like, "Dude, wake up! We're on the radio. We're on the radio." And like some of those moments, they're just priceless. They were just so amazing.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I can always remember Wilkerson telling me, there's nothing better than being on the road. And obviously he's referring to his times doing it with you guys back in the Haro days. He's a big fan. And speaking of, things that happen on the road, that I sub out some shows to Doug Morrison. And a year or two ago, he was using my boy Joe Midnikoff.
Yeah,
he's doing a lot of shows with me these days. And you guys had a little experience going through California. Did you want to share that with us?
You had to go there, John, huh? You had to go there.
Well, the guys are like, make sure you ask them about our encounter with the police.
Well, that was so classic. Yeah. So I got the call, and I was like, okay, yeah, I can do this. I can go. And it was only for a couple of days. I think I spent... we went to the coast and we did one show, and then I stayed the night and we did one more show, and we're all done. And we're driving through a national park. And mm-hmm. So the riders were partaking in cannabis, and they, completely bought it legal. It's, recreational legal in California. And so they had their little stash, and I don't really partake in that any longer. I'm much more of a CBD kind of guy, but whatever, it's all good. I have no qualms over it. Respectfully, they're doing what they want to do. And so next thing we're driving through this national park, and we get pulled over, and the officer comes up. It was a woman.
And this is in California.
This is in California.
A state that marijuana is legal.
Right. And so, okay. Sure enough, Okay, so tell me the names of the riders again. I feel silly.
Doug was in charge.
Right.
Joe was the other guy.
Yeah, Joe was the guy that was hurt.
Yeah, he's got a back problem.
Yeah, he's got a back. Okay, so I just wanted to make sure I got the right driver. So Doug was driving, and just genuinely such a nice guy and very honest, right? He's not going to, like, try to pull one over. And so the question was, I think, do you have any narcotics? I think that was the specific question. And he said, well, I have a little bit of this cannabis. And then they're like, oh, once they heard that, they pulled Joe out. They handcuffed him. They pulled me out, handcuffed me, handcuffed Doug. All three of us are sitting cuffed on the side of the road. And I'm just like, what the hell's going on
this
here?
This is California. Cannabis, what?
Yeah. And it's like, what? You know, he's being completely, you know, he showed him his little stash. And like, right. This is what he had. And this is where, you know, I bought it at a dispensary. Everything completely legal. And, you know, in their defense, they obviously, Northern California, there's probably a lot of the black market activity going on. And, you know, we're driving
through.
And
they're in a trailer.
You know, through this, you know, road. And, you know, they
could be taking it out of state.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what they're thinking. Sure.
Yeah. And I was pissed. I was like, what?
And out of state tags, mind you.
Right. That was another good point. Yeah. I'm sure that was a little bit of a red flag. But I was pissed because it's like, freaking don't cuff us, you know, like,
right.
Just talk to us. And right. So they just compensated, like, his paraphernalia and his little bit of stash that he had and let us go. But I was just in shock.
And so the problem was, is that they were on a, like a
federal land.
Because, federal park?
Yeah. So because it was federal land, then technically, and they could have, you know, I don't remember what they actually threatened, not really threatened, but they said potentially they could have done more with us because we were on federal land with
that's
cannabis.
The whole issue with cannabis, isn't it? It's like it's states will be legal, but it federally it's still what, category one drug, which is
right, which
insane,
is insane.
Yes,
yeah, category but, one. I mean, come on, let's get real. Yeah, I mean, but, yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Move to Canada. We have weed stores on every corner.
Yeah, it's federal legal across the whole
yeah,
country. Right?
I know. Across the whole country.
My uncle.
We have more weed stores. Yeah, more weed stores in my city than we have donut shops.
And that's saying something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
They love donuts, Peterborough. Anyway, well, thanks for sharing that with me. I feel bad that happened because I know we had called you. We were like, hey, we need a rider. Yeah, I know a guy. He's great. Let's call Dave Neary.
And then you got Dave arrested. Way to go, Dave.
Yeah. I mean, okay, but I'll tell you another a story that I actually got arrested and put into jail. And this one is classic. And I know I've told it before, but I think it's good to share with your audience because they'll appreciate that, you know, sometimes you reach desperate measures. So
didn't realize you're such a jailbird, Dave.
Yeah,
but okay.
I tell you, I got a long track record. I almost want to give you guys a choice because there's two. One, I'll give you a choice and you can tell me if you want to hear both of them or if you want to just hear one. But one was in Missoula, Montana, and it was me, Sean Wilkerson, so Ron's brother, and Brian Blyther. Oh. So there's that story. Or there's another story, which was on the two hip. Let me make sure. Was that on the two hip? I can't remember. But another story, which was in Philadelphia, and it was just myself that got arrested. So which one do you guys want? Which one is it?
I'm leaning towards Missoula, because that was one of my favorite places we visited on Two Hip Tour in 2003.
Okay.
Anthony,
what do you think?
Yeah. No, let's go with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Missoula, amazing town. Like, you know, it's a college town. Beautiful. Awesome. We're in the middle of the summer. Awesome drive, you know, beautiful scenery and some pretty nice looking women. I mean, let's face it, that part of the reason that you're on the road and, you know, you want to make connections, you want to meet people, and, you know, women play into that, young women, I should say. I say women, we called them girls at the time, obviously. And so Ron is with us, and Sean, Brian, and myself. But Ron is in his hotel room. He's the married one, and he's answering fan letters, because that's what Ron does. He has answered every single fan letter, and he's very dedicated. Well, we were partying. We had met these nice young ladies. We asked him to come up and have a couple wine coolers with us. When I told this story and I large Ray was listening to, he's like, "You guys are actually drinking wine coolers." Like, he was just dying. Wine coolers, that's killing me. You're killing me, Nori. And so we're sitting and we're just, you know, having a good time, just having a few wine coolers, and Brian goes out down to the van with the girl that he was, you know, hanging out with, and they decide to go into the Haro van and just kind of hang out. And so I'm with this other girl, and then Sean is with this one girl. And next thing you know, we hear this knock on the door, like, and we're like, "Holy crap!" And we got wine coolers, we got under eight. Oh, well, now just to make sure I'm clear, we drinking age is 18 in Montana at the time, so we were all legal. I'm not so sure about the girls. I think the girls were probably 16, 17. They were probably 19. They were probably old.
Yeah,
exactly. Just edit that part. Please, yeah. Eddie Roman, edit that part. You know, edit that out. So, sure enough, we open the door. Sean goes to the door, and I'm like throwing wine coolers wherever I can, stashing it. And the girls are just like freaking out. And it's the manager with this cop. And they're like, "Hey, we've got a situation down in the parking lot, and your van, apparently someone broke into it, and he claims that he's with you guys." And we're like, "Well, that's Brian probably. Let's go down." So we went down there. Brian's handcuffed in the back of this cop car.
Oh, no.
And we're like, no, that's Brian. No, he was just hanging out. No, it's all good. It's all good. So Brian's in the back, and the cop's like, "Okay, yeah, these guys, you know, got you cleared. Come on out." The second the cop released the handcuff, Brian's like, "Man, I didn't freaking do anything." And that pissed the cop off. He's like, "Okay, guys are all going down." He handcuffed me and Sean and Brian and the girls. I don't think the girls got handcuffed. They went into a different car, and we all got taken into jail.
Why?
In Missoula, Montana.
What were the charges?
Because that's where I was trying to go with it. It's like, what are you, you know, what? And it was because he, something about being disrespectful to an officer or something ridiculous.
Oh,
and he kind of like swung his arm, and I don't know what. And so here we are now. They separate us. So it's just the three of us, Sean, Brian, and I, and then the three girls in the other cell. And we're just sweating. We're just shitting a brick. Like, what the, you know? And the guy keeps coming out, and he's like, "Okay, so it's going to cost you $500 each to get out, if you want to get out tonight."
Jeez.
I'm like, what? What's the charges? And like, I don't even remember what their story was as far as the charges. And the guy was really just super.
Seems like a racket.
Yeah, he was out there. Because then he sat down, and we had this like 45-minute lecture about his divorce and his life and I don't know, like this
the
whole
cops?
Yeah, the cop did. Yeah. Yeah. And it was this whole sob story, and Brian and Sean and I were like, "What the hell?" You know, and then he would come back and he's like, "Okay, I'll tell you what. You're really lucky that it's a night when my sergeant's not here. Because if my sergeant was here, I would have to keep you, you know, overnight or and charge you for whatever he was gonna charge us with. And but I'm gonna let you guys go." And so we're like, "Yeah, thank you, officer." And, you know, "Yeah, we apologize for any misconduct." You know, I always am just like, "Just get me out. You know, I'll be
right, yeah.
happy to be
shut up, released. Shut up, just, let's go."
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Shut up, Leather. Yeah, just don't say another word. And it's funny, like, Brian's now a cop. You know, it's like he knows this rap well.
Yeah.
And so he said, "Well, the only thing I got to tell you." Oh, and then he came and he sat us, the six of us, down in the lobby, and he did another whole lecture about his life, and I don't know, he's just trying to set some I don't know, like, responsibility that we should take in our lives and blah blah blah. And we're like, "Dude, let us go, please, you know, we're on to other things now at this point." So
we got some underage girls, come on.
And so what happened at the end, he's like, "Well, there's one thing that we don't offer a ride back." And this was like way across town. I don't even remember what we did. I think we ended up taking a cab. So we went back to the hotel, and we're like, "Hey, thanks so much." You know, to the girls, we're like, "We really appreciate it." And they're like, "Oh, no, don't worry. We're going to go move our car, and we're going to park it around the corner. We'll be back." And Brian and Sean and I looked at them, like, these girls are – they just went down to jail,
And they're down for the cause.
Yeah, they're like, we're going to come back. And we're like, okay.
It's Montana.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's only so much that happens in Montana. And then the best part about the story is we show up at the bike shop. And I swear, it was so classic. The owner's like, oh, yeah, so how's everything going? How's the tour? Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's fun traveling. We got a lot of fun shows, and we're excited today. It's like, so tell us a little bit about the inside of our jails here in Missoula. Like, the word had already got out.
Fast in Missoula.
It already got out. Like, everyone knew. So there was this, like, ongoing joke, you know, and, like, even the guys that when we were signing their autographs, they were like, hey, man, that's really cool. You guys spent time, you know, in Missoula. Like, and, it, you know, for me, it was like, it wasn't really anything. I mean, obviously, it was just a little good scary. Story, yeah, it's pretty classic.
Now I got to know how you got arrested in Philadelphia.
Okay, I'll tell you that. Yeah. You know, in a brief. So I think I'm pretty sure it was the two. It was okay. Now I remember why. That I certain things that have to like jog my memory. Some of it's the announcer because I remember which year by the announcer, and then others are like the vehicle and the rig. And so now I remember. We're going to do a show in New Jersey, West Coast Cycles, really cool guy. And we're driving through Philly. And again, it's late night, probably like 10 o'clock at night. And we're driving along. And all of a sudden, we see a wheel passes by. And I'm driving. And Wilkerson's in the passenger seat. And I'm like, hey, what? Look at that wheel, dude, just cruising down the front. And Ron's like, dude, that's our wheel. And like, we pull over and we run back and we get the wheel. And now, I don't know if you guys, still, John, if you remember, but he had that old Kuoharo trailer and it had the ramp on the side, not the back, but the side. So it's a big, like 16 foot wide quarter pipe, right? And he had little wheels. It wasn't like a full size trailer, you know, regular size wheel. These little wheels, and instead of having a lug nut, it had a bolt. So it actually bolted in to the hub. And they
like
always,
several bolts?
Yeah, several bolts that would bolt in instead of a lug nut. And we would lose like Loctite and whatever we could to keep those on, but we were constantly losing them. Well, apparently we lost them all and we lost that wheel and we didn't have any more bolts. So we're driving around. We went to like this industrial area and no one's around. It's just like this total, you know, warehouses. Didn't seem like any residents were around at all. And I'm scoping out and I see this gated area with some tractor trailer equipment. And I look and I'm like, hey, they've got what we need. Those aren't lug nuts. Those are lug bolts. So I grab the crowbar and I go and I jump the fence and I'm wrenching away trying to get a couple. I wasn't going to take them all. I was just going to take a couple, you know, but just, I mean, for the sake of the kids, you know, we need to perform. Right. We had a show the next morning at 10 a.m. in New Jersey, right? We had a, so hey, that was my
happen.
Yeah, that was my drive. And so it's funny, just a little side note. My wife always says, you know, you're the most law-abiding citizen until it comes to BMX. Like, many occasions I push the envelope because the show must go on. So that's kind of what, you know, okay, I'm going to be the savior here. I'm going to go over there, you know, and the little guy will just jump over.
Liberate some bolts.
Yeah, just borrow them. We can return them on the way back. I mean,
yeah, we're going to bring them back.
I'm not going to steal them.
They would never even know they're missing.
Exactly. That thing's been sitting there for years, it looks like, you know? Okay, so here's where the story gets incredibly crazy. So I'm sitting there wrenching down. I look up, and I see Wilkerson walking down the middle of the street. So we're parked off the side. He's got his hands up, and he's going, dude, relax, relax. And there's a sergeant that lived in the apartment that was not far away that watched us and watched me jump over. He came out, pulled his gun out on Ron.
Oh, no.
Pointing his gun straight at Ron. And Ron's like, dude, in his Jimmy's shorts and his, you know, his horror shirt. And he's like, dude, just relax, relax. He's got his hands up. He's like, dude, everything's cool, relax. And the guy's like, he's this old retired sergeant. And he's like shaking. He's like, don't move it. You know, and I'm watching all this. I'm like, oh, I threw the crowbar. I jump back over the fence and the cops show up. And they separated us all, and they're like, okay, what's your story? And I'm like, well, I was just taking a piss. And they're like,
oh, is that what you said?
Yeah, that's what I said. I said, I was just pissing over there. And they're like, oh, really? Can you show us your piss mark? And that's when I was like, oh, crap. Didn't think of that, you know? Like, oh, I got too scared and I didn't piss, you know? So I basically told him, I said, look, there's a lot of kids, you know, we're on the road. There are a lot of kids looking forward to seeing us tomorrow. It's kind of a big deal for them. And I'm sorry, but yeah, I went over to borrow these nuts because our wheel fell off and we didn't have any more bolts. And the guy's like, the cop was totally cool. He's like, you know, I get it. Not a big deal. But this guy's a sergeant and we have to take you down because we got to play it by the book here. And I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, I'm sorry, man. I get it. And it's not a big deal, really, but we're going to have to take you down. So I'm like, all right. And he handcuffed me, throw me in the back. Get down. This is Philly. This is a lot different than Missoula, Montana. Let me just tell you. There's a much different vibe happening.
People are hard in Philly.
Yeah. It's like Missoula was like a cakewalk, you know?
Right.
There was nobody. I didn't see anybody. And this place, man. So the first thing that freaked me out was they're like, okay, Mr. Norton and I had to, you know, fill out this paperwork and, all right, take everything out of your pockets, you know, put it here. All right, take your shoelaces out of your shoes. And that's when apparently would hang myself over this, like, you know, like that just freaked me out, just the realization of that kind of level of situation that I was in. And so they put me in the cell. I fortunately had a cell by myself. It was just like a metal bed with a toilet and, you know, just a tiny little cell. And it was late at this time. It was probably like, by the time I ended up in the cell, it was like 1 o'clock, maybe 2 in the morning. So I'm like, all right, I'll try to go to sleep. And I put my arm down and I put my head on my arm because there's no pillows, there's no anything. And I start to just fall asleep. Right when I fall asleep, a big old cockroach like came running across my arm. And I just like freaked out. I'm like, oh, I didn't sleep that whole night. And then in the morning, I come in. It's just like a movie scene. You know, they come in like, okay, Mr. Norrie, you're free to go. And they come and unlock the gate, you know, the bars, and they open it up. And I come out and I see Sean Wilkerson and Brian, and they're like over in the lobby and they're jumping up. They're like, hey, Gumby. And I was just like, don't fuck around right now. Don't say a word. Like, just let me get past this point and then we can, you know, talk about this and party and move on. But I was just like, get me the heck out of here. And so pretty much I just signed and said, I think I pled guilty of trespassing. That's all they had me on. It was trespassing, and at that point you can just sign and then come back to a court date, and I never did. So maybe to this day I still have a warrant out in Philly.
Oh wow.
Who knows?
I wonder if there's a way
to,
yeah,
I wonder if there's a way to find that.
Wow. Well, interesting.
And that was a theme. Like, there was several times when mainly Brian and Ron would stop right before the state line, go, nope, I can't drive in the state. This is one I have got warrants in. Like, they had kept track of one. Oh, no, I definitely have warrants here. Yeah, Brian, you got to drive. Like, all the time.
I believe it. Oh, man. Well, good stories, Dave. Good stuff. Awesome. I guess we should be wrapping it up a little bit. We're getting into some hour 48 now. Just a few more questions, I guess. What are your thoughts on the One Love Jam?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I've been a few times now. I'm going this weekend, and I don't know, just having a huge, big old parking lot filled with 300 riders. And I hear that there might be a DJ showing up this time, which would be really amazing.
That would be cool.
Rumor has it. Just to throw down some tunes, and that's my formula to having a good time. It was the first One Love Jam that inspired me to, by Pedro Mello, to enter the Master of Creativity, and that would have been 2019. And that was, I put that contest way out of my league, and Pedro's like, just do it for the fun of it. And I really enjoyed it because it really pushed me. I don't know if you've ever...
Didn't you get like sixth place or something?
No. I didn't do that well. I think I ended up about 15th or something out of however many riders. But I did the first, you know, they do three rounds and you get 30 mm-hmm. seconds. And I was all banking on my like originality. So I did come up with three brand new moves for myself to submit. And it took, I was like dedicated. It's like the competitive side of me. It was a different type of competition because I was just really competing against myself more than anything else.
Sure.
And
sure.
And I pushed it. I pushed it, and I came up with some stuff, and then I qualified for the next round, which is both great news and also like, holy crap, now I got another 3 months and I got to get another...
come up with something else.
Another three tricks. And and I remember, I mean, at times it was pretty challenging for my marriage because I was like working all day and I'd head out at night and like, okay, I'm going to go ride. And I'd ride like from 7 to 10, 11 o'clock at night, just working on new stuff. And it was really a great experience. And then I was able to create one of the ones I'm most proud of is that spinning. It's like a swivel, and then I go into a crow position, which is like a yoga move, and then I press into a handstand while the bike is still spinning. And I'm still perfecting it to where I want to be able to spin longer and maybe do it even variations to it. But like because of that format, I loved it because you didn't have to just get it wired. You just had to pull it and get it filmed.
On tape.
Yeah. And the way that pushes the envelope, because you'll see riders doing incredible stuff, however consistent they are or not, it's just a great format.
Pushing the sport.
To push the envelope. So I really...
Oh, yeah.
And that
kudos
just,
to Marty for putting that contest
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
It's great.
I mean, he does amazing things for the sport and continues to this
day. Kudos to you, man, for pushing a direction that, you know, maybe... not all our evolution is going in. And I think that there's evolution in our sport that can go in any direction, and be it old school flavor or sliders or you name it.
Yeah.
Like it's, I think that's what the sport really needs is we need to demonstrate that there's a lot still possible.
Yeah, for sure. And thinking, you know, just in that there's the creative element and that there's nothing that really needs to stop you. You know, you can do whatever you feel is fit for you.
I can remember being super stoked watching your part. I just thought that was amazing. It really stoked me out. So awesome.
Well, and going back to the pedal. So I did, and I was in Germany when I was doing this, one of the reunion shows. And I thought about, hey, I don't think anyone's ever done a pedal spin bar spin. Never seen it. But, you know, a lot of times you don't really know. Someone might have done it, but I'm gonna work on that and have it be one of my, you know, original entries, because I wanted to bank on originality. And I think that's why I was able to at least qualify to that second round. And I did it. And I, you know, did a pedal spin, and I have a coaster brake so I can really lock it in. And I did a bar spin in the midst of a pedal spin. And again, that's, I give that credit to RL and Eddie Fiola for the whole pedal on the ground. Okay.
Even after all that shit talk.
Yeah. So here, you know, current 2019, and I'm still saying I'm going to put the pedal on the ground. It's okay.
I was stoked on the Miami Hopper 360 kind of spin.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize. I think I saw some recent old footage. Is what I saw of you, and you had actually done it a long time ago.
Yeah. So 85 is when I did Miami Hoppers, but I had a peg and I also had my seat in it. So I started to realize I could pivot. And then I would usually like pull a 360. That was pretty consistent. And I wish I had footage. One time in Michigan, somewhere in the Detroit area, I did like the longest, like I spun like 6, 7, 8 times and slowed down and was able to stop and pull out of it. I never had the footage, but that was like my best. But the Master of Creativity, I did like about a 540, but I did do a little no-handed, just like a real quick, took both hands off. So that was what I felt was new to something that was very old.
Right. Awesome. Yeah, very cool. All right. Well, since we're leading into the last few questions here, what are your thoughts on modern-day BMX, Flatland specifically?
I love it. I mean,
you love it.
It's kind of that both very intimidating and very exciting all at the same time. But watching, especially like the Japanese scene, it's just amazing. But all around, like just seeing how people have evolved. And I put together a new school bike and I spent some time on it. And it's a pretty steep learning curve for me to be able to do anything that I could feel show worthy or definitely not contest worthy. So I just have mad respect for it. And I just appreciate being able to have seen the the growth and the evolution over the years, for sure.
Well said. Well said. What's in store for Dave Neary with an E in the future?
I'm going to keep the E. I'm not going to drop the E. I thought about it for a second there. Yeah, I think, so going back to the Factor Freestyle, like I just want to continue to offer some entertainment, but then we just launched a website called the Factor Freestyle Collective, and what that's entailing is the show that we do on the Zoom calls with the different writers, and the same kind of thing that we'll do. We might take a little bit of a different direction this year, but just bringing entertainment stories and just some of the history of BMX, and then just offering that entertainment. And then there's the contests, which are primarily online based, maybe with some jams mixed in, because we did also do one at the old school reunion, which was a lot of fun. It was cash for radness, and we just had people come and ride and basically just gave cash for people that were busting out. So I want to do more of that. And then most recently, I really was compelled to, all the people that we had on, we started to see that they had so much value that I wanted to be able to share. So we did a summit. It's called Summit 43. It's going to start on the 43rd day of this year, which is February 12th. And it costs $43, and you get three workshops. Now, the first one is the one that we spoke about a lot, Ron Wilkerson. And he's going to basically just do it on life. And when I said to Ron, like, we want you to be the keynote speaker and just talk about life. And he's like, well, I don't need 2 hours. I could do that in 3 minutes. And like, that's exactly why I wanted to have Ron. Like, he's just, hit the way that he looks at life now and the way that he has just embraced it in so many amazing ways. I felt like that's a really, it's a gem that needs to be shared. And so he's like, well, we'll just do question and answers for the rest of the time. And I'll just fill it with fluff. And I'm like, perfect. Then we're going to have, Scott Hagness, who's out of Portland. Yeah. Amazing, amazing person. Rider.
Ride Unlimited.
What's that? Yeah.
Ride Unlimited?
Yeah, Ride Unlimited. And Joe and I are both working with him on a personal training level. And he's changed I've only been doing it for about a year, a little less than a year. And it's just changed my world. And I'll keep it short, but basically I had shoulder injuries, I had back stuff, I had things that were just slowly starting to creep up on me, and I've been able to just like handle them, and I just can't say enough about Scott. So he's going to also give a little introduction, and then people can work more with him if they choose to, but they can at least get a something. And all of us at this age can appreciate, hopefully, and value the importance of taking care of our bodies, in that way.
I'll add to that. I'm actually working with Scott right now. He's helping me with a high sit bone tightness in my butt. I've had it for several years now. And he's actually given me a whole workout routine that's helped me tremendously. In fact, I feel almost, I'd say, 85%. And I was feeling about 40% for a long time. So the man knows his stuff. So if you're having any injuries related to BMX flatland specifically, I think Scott is very knowledgeable. He seems to know.
Yeah, and even across the board. So I have a good friend here locally, this guy Gabe, and I saw him one night just out at a pizza place, and he got ran over. Is actually his dad ran him over with his tractor and jacked his leg up. And this guy is like young. He's like 30, and just like travels and does like videos for music festivals. That's like his passion. And he's like, he just was not himself. He was really down, and because of this injury, and he was doing all kinds of different work with different PTs, and it just wasn't enough. He wasn't healing quick enough, and it was a real challenge for him. And I could see it, and I said, I'm just gonna throw this out there, but I've been working with this guy Scott. You should just give him a call. And you know how you do that at times, you don't ever know. Well, I saw him like about 3 months after that at a party here, and he's a good friend with my wife's son, Jai, and he's there, and he's like, totally looks completely different. I'm like, Gabe, what's going on? He's like, dude, my life is changed. I am completely a new person. And it like,
he's working with Scott.
Yeah. And it like moved me to tears, guys. Cause this point, this person was really beaten down, you could tell. And he's like, I can't believe this guy. He's had me do all kinds of crazy stretches like no other PT. And and he's taking it on real seriously because it was really, like, I have some I have some injuries, but they're nothing major. Like, Gabe was going through some tough times. And so that was like, oh my gosh, the best testimony that I could, you know, see in my own eyes, him just transform. That's cool. You know, definitely kudos out to Scott, what he's doing. And then just to wrap it up, as far as this Summit 43, the third one is going to be Bill Nitschke. And I mean, Bill Nitschke, to tap into anything as far as what he's been able to accomplish and really about how he's been so successful creating a livelihood with something that he loves to do. And that's kind of the theme that I want him to hold, is like, he's one that shows up and shows up 100%. And gives it all, and he has a lot of secrets. And I kind of tease people about it. It's like, you're gonna see a lot of Bill, but Bill's not gonna just paint it black and white. You're gonna have to find those little gems that he's gonna share with you. And I feel like between those three, you kind of have all aspects. You have the life, you have the health, and then you have your livelihood.
Yeah.
And it's for 43
characters. Yeah, for sure.
For $43 for three 2-hour seminars that will go over 3 weeks time. I think it will be a very good value.
Interesting. Okay. And so we find it all about that on Factor Freestyle, or where do we
There's a website that we just launched called factorfreestyle.com.
Okay.
And it's called the Factor Freestyle Collective, because the idea is, I'm kind of like wanting to create something that together we can basically come together and share some of these things that we, as we're elders, you know, we can hopefully give back to some others that could appreciate it or value it.
Cool. All right. Anthony, you got any more questions for Mr. Dave Neary?
Not at this point, other than I just want to say I always felt like planting your pedal was fair game. I never had a problem with that.
Cool.
All right. Is anyone you want to thank before we let you go?
Oh, gosh. I always hate that because there's just so many people. I mentioned, you know, my sponsors. So Cool Stop is also helping me out now. Vans, you know, thank you so much for all the many years. Haro, obviously. Standard, because Rick Molinaro has been supporting me with bars for years. I've been running his bars. Reclamation Bike, cool. Obviously, because of all the travel. And then, of course, my mom, because she's the first one that helped me along the way. And can I share one little quick story? Because it just came to mind.
Sure.
I know we're at the 2-hour mark, aren't we? Oh gosh, man, I talk a lot.
That's fine.
Getting close.
Yeah, that's fine. This is a good podcast.
I get a rolling, you know. But so going back to that first contest, so interesting thing happened. I was talking about how I was doing a lot of jumping on those step ups, and I used to oftentimes land really hard flat, and I broke these forks. And I went to my mom. I'm like, oh, mom, I just broke a pair of forks, and they're like $35. You know, could you help me out? And she's like, okay. And she, you know, helped me and got me these forks. And then the very next time I went to these jumps, it was actually a new spot. I went off this big step up, landed both wheels like flat at the same time, broke the new forks off. And right at that same time, John Peterson and Tony Murray had convinced me to go to this contest to the AFA in Huntington Beach. And I'm like, gosh, I really want to go, but I got to get new forks. So I went to my mom. I'm like, mom, is there any way I could get some money for some forks? And she's like, David, I just gave you money for forks. I said, I know, but I already broke those. She's like, oh my gosh, I can't keep up. And this is my mother's single mom working, you know, she has four kids. And
$35 bucks was a lot of money. Exactly.
And
too.
So she literally said, you know, I want to support you, but the only way we can do this is that we're going to have a family meeting. We're going to have to get all your brothers together. We're going to have to talk about this because, you know, I only have so much money to the next pay. You know, she's paying, living paycheck to paycheck. So we had the family meeting. My three brothers and I were there. And my mom said, okay, I literally have like $150 in the checking account. If I buy David's forks, we have to live until payday in whatever food that's left in the cupboards and the refrigerator. There's no like extra, you know, we're not going to Roberto's for burritos. We're living off of this. At least for
everyone's going hungry, so Dave can get some new forks.
Yeah, so basically for the next whatever it was, a week or 10 days, I can't remember exactly. And all my brothers like, oh yeah, no, buy him the forks, mom. No, we're good. We'll eat top ramen and just, you know, rice and beans, whatever it takes. And so, you know, looking back at that, like, what if they would have said no and I never went to that contest? we might not be having this podcast right now.
Well, shout out to your brothers.
I know. Yeah. So that was a huge, huge, and still to this day, they're obviously very supportive of it.
Very cool. Wow. Thanks, Dave. Yeah. Really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to riding with you next week, too.
I know. That's what's so great, John, is that we get to go shred in just a few days. So that's awesome. And Anthony, really nice to meet you. And I really appreciate what you guys are doing, because it's awesome just to have more stories out there and more people, you know, exposed to some of the riders that have been around.
I appreciate it, and having riders like you and Rick on, and I mean that's the guys I grew up with, and I appreciate you spending the time with us.
Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome.
All right, guys. Thanks again, and have a good night.
All right. Good night, guys. Take care.
All right. Cheers.
Bye.
You're listening to Banter, a BMX podcast with John Doker and Anthony Berardi.